Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and today we're going to take you on a little tour around the world.
We're going to go around the world. We're going to go back in history. Who knows what we're going to do?
Yeah, but we're going to start with a really brilliant writer and food writer, Anja von Bremzen, who has written a book that documents the evolution of Soviet cooking. Of course, she's Russian-born, but let her tell the story. It's been getting raves by everybody, including the New York Review of Books. The last time we talked to Anja von Bremzen, we were talking about the new Spanish table. So that goes back a ways, Anja. And I wanted to say that you get all kinds of credit for being an extraordinary food writer, which you are. But reading this confirms what I've always thought, is that you are just an excellent writer, period.
Oh, thank you so much. That's the kindest thing anyone has said to me. I'm really flattered. Thank you.
Oh, but you are. You know that. And it's just your subject happens to be food for the most part. But there's something about this current book which goes way, way beyond just the food. It's food as a trigger, shall we say, or as a hook. The title is Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking, and it's subtitled A Memoir of Food and Longing. Can you explain the subtitle?
Thank you. The subtitle is really crucial. Obviously, the title is as a send-off of Julia Child, and it's deeply ironic because mastering is such a Soviet concept. You know, we mastered the universe, and Soviet cooking is a little bit of an oxymoron, but the subtitle, Memoir of Food and Longing, is really the heart of this book, because so much of this memoir is about fantasizing about food. It's about dreaming about food. It's about food that we imagined but knew that we could never taste. For instance, the first chapter is about me and my mother back in Moscow reading Russian classics, Tolstoy, Nikolai Gogol, Anton Pavlovich Chekhov, who devote such orgiastic, beautiful pages to food and to dishes that we could never try and couldn't even imagine because of the shortages of such decadent Tsarist-era ingredients. So for this chapter, my mother and I recreate a kulibyaka, a sumptuous fish pie from the pages of Gogol. And we also say goodbye to the cuisines of the Tsars. And much of it is about, you know, just imagining, sitting there back in Moscow and drinking weak tea and imagining how such a dish would taste. So desire, longing, fantasy. At some point in the book, I say that dreaming about food is more rewarding than actually eating.
Yes, I'm not sure about that, but on the other hand, I do kind of sublimate when I read cookbooks. That's almost as good for me as actually cooking the recipes.
Yes, who doesn't, you know, lie there at night, leafing through pages of something and kind of fantasizing about it. But for us, you know, in Russia, living behind the Iron Curtain, not having access to the West and not having access to Western dishes, I mean, in my childhood, I tasted a banana once a year, and it was just rapturous, exotic experience that I would think of for the rest of the year. This kind of intensity in relation to food, you know, really defined the Soviet experience. And this is one of the things that I wanted to put on paper.
Well, you did. You introduced us, the readers, to this intensity about food, which I never knew existed, actually.
Yeah, I think you have to really be deprived of something to appreciate. And, of course, my life, it's very ironic that I became food writer and I work for such wonderful magazines as Travel and Leisure and Food and Wine, who send me on this incredible assignment around the world, eating dishes at best restaurants. But I felt like I was leading a double life almost, that here I was, incredible career as a food writer, and with a past in which I've never seen an avocado, and in the past in which a lot of times my mom and I would just eat black bread scrambled with some eggs. And something in me just kind of wouldn't reconcile. There was, over something, everything I ate for my job, there would be a shadow, something darker, kind of more existential related to food, this collective desire and yearning. And also, you know, this huge epic political history. Because think of this, the Soviet Union in 1917 started with rationing, and it started, in part, happened because of the bread riots, because the peasants weren't eating
right.
enough, and the Bolsheviks quickly introduced rationing. Then in 1991, the Soviet Union ended with rationing because the distribution system under Gorbachev was breaking down, and they had to reintroduce rationing coupons. And in the middle, there was World War II with its own rationing. So what I do in the book, it's a particular structure. I go decade by decade of the Soviet experience. So the book starts in 1910 with Farewell to the Tsars. So it's the teens, then 1920s, 1930s, 1940s with the catastrophic World War II. And it ends in present day, in 2010, you know, in present day Moscow under Putin.
How are you able to go back and forth the way you have?
Well, when we left, my mother and I emigrated in 1974 as Jewish refugees, and we became stateless. We had no winter coats, and we had two tiny suitcases. And we left essentially for dead. We thought we'd never be able to go back.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was the Iron Curtain. They allowed very few people out, and you emigrated without a right of return. And then Perestroika happened, and suddenly under Gorbachev, they reopened the border, and they allowed the immigrants back. So we went back in 87. From 1974 to 87, 13 years, we have not seen our family. I have not seen my father. And that first visit was really like a miracle, and I describe it in the book, the kind of sense of learning from the dead, you know, and eating with the family again, and the reunion between my father and my mother. And then after that, we were able to go back and forth freely, and my mother and I returned quite often. And during the perestroika and during the collapse of the Soviet Union, I was traveling with my ex-boyfriend all over the former Soviet republics as the Soviet Union was falling apart, which was very dramatic.
Oh, so that's incredible.
The chapter in the book, the 1990s chapter, is about the collapse.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to envision, actually, even though we've lived through it. I would say that this book is a social history, a political history, a cultural history, your personal history, and as well as people that you never even met, their history. How did that all come together? Your mother was pivotal, right?
Yes, my mother is important. It's almost as much her memoir as it is mine. Well, everyone always said to me, and I always felt that I should do a memoir about connected with food in the USSR, but I didn't want to do it just as my story. I wanted to be the story, the epic, tragic, dramatic story of the Soviet Union as told from the kitchen table. I wanted something that would humanize that Soviet experience, because people think that totalitarian regimes obliterate humanity. But it's not true. You know, human lives went on, and they were more intense. And, of course, they were tragic. You know, people were being arrested and killed. So I wanted to show the human side of Soviet life. And it was my mother who proposed the structure. She said, why don't you structure the book as a series of metaphoric meals that spans the entire Soviet century? So my mom and I decided that we would cook our way through every decade of the Soviet experience. So part of the book is our family history, my grandparents, my parents, my generation, that spans from 1910 to the present. Part of the book, as you say, is social history and history, but told in this intimate way, as if around the kitchen table, and as it sort of pertains to the, you know, deeply human experience. And the other part of the book is the cooking chronicle of my mother and I in New York, recreating these dishes and reminiscing with her friends. And it sounds very complicated, but in fact, you kind of, as you write, you find your way and you find a story, which of the stories, you know, propels the narrative forward. You know, I was always asking myself, what turns the pages? What is interesting? And in the end, you know, it is a family memoir. It is a human story about three generations of my family and their complicated relationship with food, with totalitarian power, But it also has historic characters. Lenin, there's Stalin, there's Nikita Khrushchev, Gorbachev. All these leaders appear, and sort of a cast of historic characters. But hopefully it came out in a way that's absorbing to read.
Yes, well, it is, because it reads almost like a novel. It's hard to remember that it's real.
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, that was the intention. I have to say, immodestly, that I was very inspired by War and Peace by Tolstoy. I mean, that was kind of my model. You know, I was always astounded in the way that small human stories unfold against, you know, this huge, you know, dramatic epics of history and how they intertwine. And I felt that in the Soviet Union, the personal was the political. There was nothing outside politics. And I wanted to show that, you know, people's intimate relationship with power, with totalitarian realities. And food is a great way to kind of humanize that epic.
Now, I was thinking, and I actually read War and Peace. I never did read Anna Karenina. I wasn't ready for another one. But both of them are really very suitable for making brick chicken. And I'm pleased to say, and listeners, please bear this in mind, that although Anna copied Tolstoy and the other great Russian writers in writing her book, she was wonderfully brief. Because this one weighs in at only a couple of pounds and about 250 pages.
Exactly.
But it'll probably be made into a movie, don't you think?
Who knows?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I hope.
Tell me some of the, because when I think back to the food scenes in Russian novels, I could just get the sense of lavish banquets and that sort of thing, or on the other end, like the maggoty meat and the whole thing with Potemkin. Tell me what meals you found to be really impressive and significant in defining your story.
Well, for my book, Mom and I looked for an emblematic dish for each of the decades. So we begin with the sumptuous fish pie called kulibaka that kind of exemplifies the excess of the Tsars. And this was the kind of cuisine that the Russian people said goodbye to after the revolution and after the ingredients disappeared and after this kind of Tsarist decadent cuisine became ideologically incorrect and, you know, the Bolsheviks were fighting this kind of thing. For the 1920s, I talk a lot about my Jewish relatives and whole situation with the Jewish identity under the new Soviet state in the 20s. So we're making gefilte fish from the recipe of my mother's grandmother. Then for the 1930s, Stalinist kind of food culture is born, and we made Russian hamburgers, which became kind of an industrialized mass market product. So it goes, you know, every chapter has its own dish, you know, connected to what's happening in Russia and to our own personal history.
But you actually, really, these dishes set off all this nostalgia for you, like this hamburger, what's it called?
Kotlete.
Yeah, that sends you into a remembrance, like a Proustian thing. In fact, talk about Proust. I loved the title of your preface, or the prologue, I guess it's called, Poisoned Madeleines. Can you explain that?
Well, exactly, because nostalgia, Proust, you know, novelistic Madeleines, the cookies kind of set off this reveries about an idealized childhood, and it's become kind of a literary cliche almost to use food to invoke something, a lost idyllic moment in your past. But what I say by the phrase poisoned Madeleines is that a lot of our past was tragic and not idyllic, but we still cling to it and we still cling to the foods, even if the foods were produced by a repressive state that we eventually fled. So everything in this book, all the nostalgia in this book is kind of bittersweet or sweet and sour. You know, even if it's happy, it's always tinged with sadness or loss because the Soviet history was so complicated.
Where are we now? And you end up your last visit. You're very aware of the metaphor with the poison Madeleines because of the rise of nostalgia you found in your last visit.
Yeah, the last chapter is about me and my mom being back in Putin's Moscow, which is kind of the land of the oligarchs and people paying, you know, $8 for an espresso and sushi flown in from Tokyo and, you know, mozzarella flown in from Italy. And in the middle of all this, well, there are several interesting things in that chapter. One is that I got invited to do a television cooking show on Russian television with a former Kremlin chef. Uh-huh. And we cooked on Kremlin china, on Kremlin porcelain. And he brought in a Chinese crystal set of cut crystal balls that belonged to Stalin. So that was very kind of scary and unsettling. And the other thing was that my mom and I were both astounded that amidst all this kind of oil-fueled wealth and consumerism, suddenly people are nostalgic for the USSR and for the foods and for the frugal foods that define our existence. And this nostalgia is kind of being marketed.
Yeah, there's a brand new restaurant.
Various brands, you know. It was very strange.
There's a huge fancy restaurant. Where would you pin in London? I can't remember what it's called now. Do you know about it?
Well, Novikov, one of the restaurant emperors from Moscow, just opened a place in London, but it's not Russian. I think it's just more Asian.
No, this
but there's
is...
you know, there's a fancy supermarket inside the Goom department store, which is the fancy department store near the Red Square, which is full of Gucci and Prada. Inside there, they opened a supermarket called Gastronom Number One, which is devoted to Soviet nostalgic products.
And you and your mother found that very strange, right?
We found it very strange because, again, I mean, past was so complicated. People are nostalgic. People are talking well of Stalin, if you can imagine. I think there was a lot of horrible about the Soviet regime, obviously. So just to kind of have this unqualified nostalgia for it that's being commercialized all the time, it's not the same as being nostalgic for mac and cheese. It's not the same as just kind of another retro food trend. Because, you know, because the regime was so complicated and so, you know, evil in many ways.
I also enjoyed your Khrushchev stories. Like, I didn't know it meant corn.
It's interesting now. I mean, kids, you know, Russian kids, like, don't know anything about Soviet history. But when you say Nikita Khrushchev, what people think in the West is, you know, banging, the shoe banging at the United Nations. What people in Russia say... Kukuruza, corn, because he was obsessed with planting corn everywhere, and he was just made all these crazy agricultural schemes. And in fact, he was enthralled by a visiting farmer from Iowa.
Oh my!
Yeah, so this idea for corn was from America, and they started planting corn all over the place in like northernmost parts of the country. And initially, it started growing, and then you know it went dead. So it was kind of one of those crazy harebrained schemes that went nowhere, and there was a huge amount of corn propaganda to try to get people as well to cook from corn. So there's all these chefs demonstrating corn recipes, and, you know, Russian people didn't like corn. They didn't know corn, because if you lived south of the country, you knew corn, but the northern parts, nobody knew about corn, and nobody, you know, wanted to eat cornbread. It was very funny in retrospect, but kind of tragic for Khrushchev's career.
Well, do we end up then with not knowing the future, essentially, under Putin? Hello?
Yeah, hello.
Yeah, so we end up not knowing what the future will bring under Putin.
Well, it's looking very disturbing at the moment. Civil liberties are being taken away. I mean, I'm not very optimistic. But at least compared to how it was, people can travel. They have a certain level of material well-being. And for the last election, for the mayor election, a lot of people just didn't show up for vote. Looks like it's evolving at a passive society that just takes what it can. And we'll see. I think Putin is there for a long time.
I think he's there for a long time. I think he's the scariest man on earth, to be perfectly honest. And I guess from your answer, we're not looking for the new Russian cuisine to emerge very soon.
Well, interestingly, because there's so much money and because there's so much resources, yes, I mean, some chef called Anatoly Kom, who's done, you know, doing a molecular Russian cuisine. There are young chefs who are doing interesting things with domestic products. So Moscow essentially copies London in terms of restaurant trends, and the restaurant scene is incredible. So, in fact, it's very possible that we'll end up with an interesting cuisine.
Interesting. Well, I hope you keep us informed about it, Anya.
I would be delighted.
And I hope that after writing this book, because I know it was a very emotional process for you, I hope that you feel some sort of sense of catharsis in having confronted the feelings you have about food as a result of your childhood. Do you?
Yes, I think it always helps to write things down And it's been a long journey. And, you know, my mother was my fellow traveler on this journey. We cooked together. We spent a lot of time together reminiscing. And my mom and I, we were always very close. But this project brought us even closer. And now she's really enjoying all the publicity. You know, people come to film her. There was a beautiful article about us in Food and Wine magazine in the September issue. So she's very much the star of all the reviews, and I think it's very gratifying. Because my mother is really an amazing, amazing person, and the book is about her, and the book is for her, and that was the most gratifying part, aspect of the experience.
You are a good daughter and also a good writer.
Thank you so much.
And a good historian. I thank you for writing the book and for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to be with you again.
Thank you, Anya.
Thank you.
A really fascinating subject and a really fascinating book that uses history as a metaphor, if you like, for the evolution of food. I don't know how you describe it. It's well worth the read, and we certainly enjoy talking to Anya about it. And after the break, we're going to take off in a slightly different direction to a slightly different part of the world. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, we're taking two of the hottest trends in the food world, one being street food, which everybody seems to have taken to, and the second is Latin American flavors. Combining it, what do we have? We have Latin American street food. So let's listen to Sandra Gutierrez. Everybody seems to suddenly be in love with street food, and of course at the center of this passion is Latin America. Sandra Gutierrez, you wrote originally the New Southern Latino Table, and now your latest one is Latin American Street Food, which you subtitle as the best flavors of markets, beaches, and roadside stands from Mexico to Argentina. Now, that's a whole big job to tackle.
It is, but it's a fun one.
Right.
Now, is street food, let's start from this point of view, is street food a really big part of the culinary culture?
It actually is. It's different from here in the United States, where we know street food mostly as festival food or special occasion food. In Latin America, it's a way of life. It's something that since the 1970s has become an element of everyday life for millions and millions of Latinos, all the way from Mexico to Argentina, people who can no longer go back home to eat lunches because the streets are so congested and cities have grown so much.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I can imagine now, because we just got back from Lima, Peru, which now tunes in at somewhere between seven and eight million people, and the traffic is really terrible. So that one of the reasons for the popularity is people just can't go home to get a cooked lunch.
They can't go home, and street food vendors there in Latin America cater to home cooking in the streets. So it's not like you're always eating festival-like food that you would relate to here, but you're actually finding the stews, the soups, the salads, food similar to what you would eat at home if you had the chance to go back. So it is very important.
Now, you mentioned, when I said enormous task, you mentioned in your introduction that there are over 20 different cuisines in Latin America, and each one boasts a wide array of foods.
I always say that you cannot box Latin American cuisines together because there are 21 very dissimilar cuisines, each one of which has been formed by different world cultures. So, for instance, if you were to eat in Peru, it would be completely different than the food of Mexico, than the food of Guatemala, than the food of Cuba, because different world cultures at different times in the past few centuries have made indelible marks in the cuisine of each single place. It was fascinating.
In Peru, you had also the Japanese Peruvian.
Correct.
And you had the Chinese Peruvian.
The chifas, yeah.
And then there's all over the country. There, I forget how many different, not just languages, but also cuisines in each region.
Every region is different than what you will eat in the streets in every place, in every city.
Yeah,
in every
if you
town,
multiply that to all these countries, are there any commonalities?
Yes, the two commonalities that I would find is all throughout Latin America you will find tamales. They will be named different things in the streets, humitas in Argentina, tamales in Guatemala, chuchitos, bollos, or pasteles, depending what country you're in. But it is that dumpling that has been wrapped in some kind of a wrapper where it is either banana leaves or corn husk, a vegetable leaf, that has been steamed. Sometimes it's stuffed with meat. Sometimes it's savory, sometimes it's sweet, but that's one of the commonalities. And the second thing that is common to all of Latin America are empanadas. And those are breaded, or empanada means really to encase in bread, so it's any kind of handheld pie that you can eat anywhere. Sometimes it's made from plantain, sometimes it's made from wheat flour, but we do have those two things in common. And you will find that in every single country in Latin America, they're all different, again, according to where you are and what country, what city. But the commonality of the concept is there.
Now, there'll be some things that are ingredient-driven, I guess. So, for example, in Peru, you'll be likely to get a lot of potatoes and things, but perhaps in Argentina, where they don't grow as many potatoes, you wouldn't see those.
Correct, and that's where you will find your meat, your sausages, things like that in the street. Now, of course, potatoes are native to Peru, so you will find them transformed in the streets in very interesting ways, from just boiled and served with sauces, or simply boiled, sliced, and served as a side dish, as a side to a ceviche so that you can sop up the citrus juices. And sometimes built in Peru alone as causa, which is a layered potato salad that's stuffed with some mayonnaise-based salad in the center. And they're beautiful salads. So you can find potatoes in all different ways. But in other Latin American countries, you will also find potatoes. French fries, of course, are hot in the streets of every country in Latin America. But in Cuba, you will find them transformed into papas rellenas, which are stuffed, and I have a great recipe in the book. They're stuffed potato balls. They're large. They're about the size of a ping pong ball to a golf ball size, and sometimes even bigger, like a tennis ball, depending what part of the country you're in. And they're always stuffed with some kind of meat inside. Mine in the book are stuffed with a picadillo, which is a ground beef and spice melange. In some places like Peru, you will find that potatoes can be dressed with spicy hot sauces, but in countries like Cuba, you will find that there's no heat in the food at all. So it varies. You will find ingredients that are more prevalent in some countries than in others. For example, you can find yuca, or cassava root, in places like Brazil and Panama and Venezuela, and you will not find as much of that if you go to Mexico, for instance.
Yeah, part of that,
I guess, is the ingredient doesn't grow then. Now, I think it's an interesting question anyway, as a geographer, because you have a country like Chile, which has enormous north-south length, and as a result exists in several different climatic zones from almost equatorial to almost Antarctic. Is there a variation in the regions of the country in the kind of food that you will see on the streets?
Yes, you will. There are places, you know, you will find more soups and more stews and something more like that. And there are places where you will find more of a Germanic, like the cities, like Santiago, for instance, you will find more of the Germanic elements in the pastries that you'll find in the streets. And then depending what part of Chile you're in, you will find also some neighboring similarities with the countries that they're around. So you'll find both in Peru and in Chile a donut that's made with butternut squash and sweet potatoes called picarones. And these are different from any other donut because they're yeast-based, but they're not eaten only by themselves. They're actually drenched in a syrup made with piloncillo or panela, which is the dark, unrefined sugar. So you will find variances in every single region of every country. That's what makes this so interesting, what makes Latin American food so exciting, and for me in particular, what makes it so challenging in a good way to teach, because there is so much out there that is still undiscovered to the average palate. But there are not dishes in particular that are so different that people can think of Latin American food as exotic. And that's, I think, one of the things that I would like to dispel. Because of all the different cultures that we're talking about having melded in different places, you will find, for instance, that if you like Italian food, and if you go to Argentina, you will find a lot of dishes that you will love there, like pastas and gnocchis and pesto-like sauces like the chimichurri because of the Italian influence in the cuisine. And if you like Cantonese-style food, if you go to Peru, for instance, you will find all the fried rices and different kinds of stir-fries, transformed, of course, in the Peruvian way, but similar enough for you to be able to relate. And it is like that in every single Latin American country. So but different cuisines are really a bridge into connecting people from different areas in the world. And that's why I find Latin American food so exciting. Fusion is a term that is a new term in cuisine, if you think of it, really based from the 1980s when Norman Van Aken coined it. But Latin American cuisines have been a fusion of cultures and of flavors and ingredients from the globe since its onset, since Christopher Columbus discovered the New World.
Yeah, he's a doll, isn't he?
Yes.
He liked your book.
Christopher Columbus?
Norman Van Aken.
Oh, I love Norman. He's a great buddy of mine, and I admire his work.
We interviewed him about his last book, too, with his son.
Yes,
that was cute.
Now, what's with this thing called fried ceviche? We had ceviche till it was coming out of our ears and nostrils when we were in Peru.
I like octopus.
But how do you fry ceviche?
It's really funny because this is there you go again with another Asian kind of influence in the cuisine. First of all, fried ceviche is a new fad or a new trend in Peru.
Okay.
So it's not something that has been established for a long time, and it's a street trend that is now going into restaurants. But it's basically like a tempura. That's what you're doing. In my recipe, I do it with rice flour because that's what I tasted, was something that was not coated heavily in a batter, but it just coated very lightly in rice flour. You deep fry it quickly, and then you serve it with a salsa criolla, which is a mixture of citrus and red onions and ají amarillo, which is a beautiful bright yellow pepper of Peru, and which is what you would use for typical ceviche, and you put that on top of the fried ceviche. So you can make it with shrimp, you can make it with calamari, you can make it with fish, and it's fabulous. And it's a great way of introducing people to ceviches who are a little weary of eating raw seafood.
Right, but you actually get some of the same flavors in the dressing that you put on these little fried parcels.
Absolutely.
You know, here's one I don't know. I've never had it, and I don't understand that you have it in your book. It's elotes locos.
Elotes locos. Elotes locos are one of the most whimsical, fun, and truly comforting dishes that you'll find in the streets of Mexico and Central America. And what it is you grill a corn, just the whole corn on the cob,
yeah.
And then you dip it in a sauce that's made with crema, which is a light sour cream, not as tangy, and mayonnaise. So you dip it in that, and then you roll it in cotija cheese, which is the Parmesan cheese of Mexico. It's a very salty, almost feta-like. And then you sprinkle it with chili pepper. And what makes them so exciting is that you really have to use your imagination to eat them without worrying.
Yes, I'm looking at it, you see. And I'm thinking I wouldn't have a clue how to deal with this.
I would think you would have to walk away with a mess.
You do. You make a mess, but that's why you're in the streets. You know, there is no elegance in the streets other than to have fun. And it is really a great, great recipe. When we were shooting that photo that you have in the book, the photographer kept asking me, why are you making 16 corns? We just need one for the photo. And I said, wait. And then he took the first bite, and everybody ate them all up. So it was very funny. It's something very addictive.
Well, I have to look out for those next time I'm in Central America or something.
Now you're in North Carolina, right?
I am.
Now, we were just in Greenville, South Carolina. And they have a very, very small beginning of street food. I think they have only 6 or 7 trucks.
Yes.
And the city government is still trying to set the rules.
Yes.
Is it the same way in North Carolina, too?
It is exactly the same way. And in some places like Chapel Hill and Carrboro, they're making more inroads. Raleigh is just starting to organize some of the food truck parks and festivals. I really got the idea from the book in Portland, because when I visited Portland for the food conference with a bunch of friends, they are so famous for their food truck parks, where they have all these food trucks from all over the place.
Oh, yeah, they have lots of them. There must be 100 food trucks in Portland.
Yeah, but they're arranged in pods. I mean, they're a little bit more advanced than just what
They've been doing it a long time, and they like those kinds of, they like new trends like that.
Absolutely, and I hope that some other states are going to pick up on that, on the model, because it was fascinating to just go and be able to eat and not have to worry about where they're going to be allowed to park and such. In Latin America, you have no such thing. In Latin America, you have street food on the beaches, you have it on the streets, you have it behind the house, you have a little caseta or a little house in front of the bus station. I mean, it's wherever you can get it, you know.
And people just go ahead and do it whether they're supposed to or not, I guess.
That's right. That's right. And whether there are laws or not.
Who cares about the rules?
Yeah, that's right. People have to eat.
This Cuban sandwich is when I had a Cuban relative for a while. He would do his Cuban sandwich using a brick.
A brick, yes. And if you don't have a panini press or you don't have, it's very easy to do it actually even with one a heavy skillet over another.
Uh-huh.
So you just place the bread. For those of you who don't know what a Cuban sandwich is, it's a piece of pork and delicious ham and Swiss cheese with pickles in a bread that has crust. So it's usually an Italian roll or a Cuban roll, which be the ideal thing. But you normally don't find that everywhere. And you just layer all these delicious fillings in this sandwich, and then you put your Swiss cheese in it, and you weigh it down as you press it, and it's really the original panini of Latin America. It is absolutely out of this world.
Now, is that different than a medianoche?
It is the same, but the medianoche is smaller,
okay. And
so you only eat part of it. And the names are confusing, but it's basically the same thing.
Well, you sure know your food, and this book is really just chock-a-block with information.
Thank you, and
great photography too, I might add.
Thank you. We had a lot of fun shooting the photos and eating our way through the book.
Oh, I want this flounder ceviche with corn nuts. I love corn nuts.
It's so good.
Well, anyhow, I thank you once more for talking to us, Sandra Gutierrez, and the book is Latin American Street Food, which is hot on all of our minds right now.
It is, huh?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you both so much for inviting me on your show. I really appreciate it.
It's getting towards dinner time. We better go make some.
Go make some.
thank you for joining us today, Sandra, on the menu.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Bye-bye.
And we'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
In our last segment, we took a leap across geography. This next segment, we're going to take a leap across history. And why don't we let the family explain? A project which takes historical food, historical feasting, and brings it up to date to the 21st century. What an undertaking.
Well, this is certainly a wondrous book, Scheherazade's Feast.
I'm glad you like it.
I can't think of a more distressing time to have it at the same time of the most beneficial time at the prospect of losing so much in the Middle East, to have here this book about the foods of the medieval Arab world. And it's certainly, I worry about the realities of losing the antiquities in the Middle East with all the chaos right now. And this, you've taken a piece of it and you've preserved it. You ought to be congratulated. Such a lot of work, too.
Thank you.
And so we have now Habib Salum, and he has a very lengthy resume. And how many cookbooks, Habib?
7 cookbooks.
And you were the culinarian.
I was the one that redacted the recipes. My girls did the research and history.
Yeah,
I did a little bit, but I did mostly the redacting of the recipes.
Right. And the girls are Muna Salum and her twin sister Layla Salum. Is it Elias?
Elias.
And where are you ladies? You're not even in the same place.
Exactly. I guess that's what happens with twins. They split up at some point in life. So I'm in Toronto with my dad, and my sister is in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Anyhow, you said it took you 8 years, and I would say at least, to do this cookbook. Tell us a little bit about the process. You went back to the original Arabic references for these recipes?
Yes, we went back to the original manuscript. We used 6 books between the 10th and the 13th century. Written in Arabic. We translated the recipes, the stories, and the anecdotes. Then we did we redacted the recipes. Then we put in the recipes as they were originally entered, and then what we did to them, and then the finished version where anybody could pick the book up and cook the recipe.
Now, tell us, before we move forward, why did you include the difficult original instructions for the recipe?
Here, let me answer that. Is that okay?
Yeah.
We wanted to show the type of diversity in the cooking methods in the medieval period. The earliest manuscript we have is from the 10th century. That is the extant manuscript. There were others prior to the 10th century, but to date, only the 10th century one, Al-Warraq from Baghdad, his book is available. And it now has been, it has been translated into English as well. However, we decided, before we knew it was in English, we had gone ahead and translated our own versions of the recipes. We included difficult ones and simple ones, simply because we want the audience, the reading audience, to see the kind of cuisine that was available at the time and the kind of effort that was taken to create a dish.
Now, hold on just a second. Before we go too much further along, tell our listeners who are not as well aware as we and you are, who exactly was Scheherazade and why did he or she have a feast?
Scheherazade was the heroine of the 1001 Arabian Nights.
Right.
That was translated into English decades ago, I believe maybe in the late 1800s, or no, mid-1800s. But Sir Richard Burton was a translator. I think Fitzgerald, if my father can correct me, was another translator. And she became the heroine of the story for keeping herself alive by telling her husband, Shahriar, a story every night, but not finishing it till the next night and beginning another one.
And so
she has the whims of a very intelligent woman. Well, how to I guess, get her man wrapped around her finger.
Do you know, I read that. Believe it or not, it seems like a long, I mean, it was a very long time ago. But I wonder how many people really read it today. It's a wonderful book.
I think from the Arab literature, that's the most famous piece of literature that's been around now for, a couple of hundred years at least. And it's well read by a certain class of people, you know. The middle class usually read it, and the upper classes. And people that used to be Orientalists loved the stories.
Because there were two versions. There was the abridged and the unabridged.
Uh-huh.
When we were kids, my dad and mom read us the abridged.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Get it? Right?
That's probably what I read, too.
Now, that's right.
Now, I was surprised you do not have any maps in this book.
That's right. Because
we wanted to concentrate just on the cooking and the cuisine, not make it too academic, but at the same time academic. We just wanted to show really what people ate, what the upper echelon of society enjoyed in their lives, what they ate, what they wrote about. Some of the recipes are poems that present a dish.
Yeah.
It was a time of high culture in Baghdad, and what better to enjoy life than to eat food and to make it more appetizing each time you made it. So the nitty-gritty of the recipes were written down for future generations to enjoy. It also, another, I wanted to make this point as well. Growing up in Canada and going through the educational system, which was great, there was a vacuum, though, with the Arab history. And whenever it touched upon the Arabs or Syria or Egypt or whatever Arab country, there was always, you always studied it during some war, some colonization, some imperialistic move on the Middle Eastern countries. We wanted to show that people actually lived, enjoyed life, were real people. They ate, they danced,
they ate
it.
A lot. They absolutely ate a lot, didn't they?
We wanted the food itself to see how it was. We all cook Arabic food. My mother and father lived all their lives here, most of their lives here, and they only ate Arabic food. And then when I grew up, I traveled to North Africa and the Middle East, and we saw the food that they were producing there, you know, especially during Ramadan when they had the sweets on the streets. And it was a great, and we thought through the years, why not tell the people about it? Not very many people know about it. We created the foods, and I'm happy to say that most of the dishes were excellent. Like, they ate well. Actually, some of the recipes which have come down to us today, they have less spices in them. They're not as good as the ones that they used to have then, because then I guess the affluence of society, which died away through the centuries, lost a lot of its power of emphasizing the food. And the foods were good. We enjoyed nearly every dish.
Now, hold on just a second. You attempted something else as well, though, that's even more remarkable, in that you translated the dishes and described them in a way that people can make them in their own modern kitchen if they feel so inclined.
Yes, we had to, some of the herbs and the condiments that they used, we had to find different herbs. Not very many, but some of them, like lavender, which people don't use today that much.
Or a
condiment called Murray, which...
Murray, right.
Yeah, it was a Roman invention, I think. And they took it over all through the medieval ages. And so we found, like, mismo, Japanese soy sauce, sort of. And the great writer, food writer, historian, Charles Perry, he says that you could use soy sauce instead of Murray and that. Things like that we changed. And all these recipes that they had, they didn't have any like 2 pounds or 1 cup or they just said use coriander, use ginger, use so we had to set test the recipes, make the recipes first, test them. So it wasn't too hard for me because I've been creating recipes and to put the recipes to modern use. So we took the recipes that they had. You had to have, like they'd say, put in beef and chicken and with coriander. But we had to, find the qualities.
Mind you, there were some recipes that do have some measurements when it comes to flour or sometimes meat where they would say a ruffle. A ruffle is almost equivalent to a pound here. It's somehow, but not necessarily would the recipe work out if we took that as gospel.
Right. This is no different from my grandmother's recipes, which I can't use either.
Using common, like I grew up with a household where mom and dad both cooked, and my mom learnt from her mother, and her mother learnt from her mother, etc. So the tradition was always passed on orally. And when we were kids, my mother taught us how to make bread dough, Arabic bread. She taught us how to make the, like, roll grape leaves, that kind of stuff. And we did it by eye, because she always said there should be a little bit more meat than rice when it comes to the filling in the grape leaves, for example. So there was no measurement, really. So we do it by eye and by taste. In this case, we had to be more specific in the sense that most of the readers will not be familiar with this cuisine.
Exactly. Now, you have the recipes and little stories surrounding it, little bits of history, and then you also have menus at the back of the book, like a dinner during Ramadan. And then you broaden it, though. You have also not just the Arab holidays, you have a dinner during Lent. I mean, they're not just Muslim. They're broader. And a dinner during Passover.
Right.
And why did you decide to do that?
It was the idea of our publisher, the University of Pennsylvania Press, the great publisher we had, Dr. Jerry Singerman. He was the one that suggested that we create menu items. And he understands because society there included, it's not just Arab Muslims. There's Arab Christians and there were Arab Jews, okay? So all of them participated in these kinds of foods when it came to their special holidays. The Lent dishes are spectacular because they are Lent dishes because the Arab Christians practice Lent. There's a lot of dishes as well for those who are of the Jewish faith because they cannot eat certain foods at certain times during the Sabbath, etc. So all of these are included in these medieval cookbook texts, especially the 13th century books. They have specific items for example, Lent, what the Christians eat during Lent. Also, they have a section on what to eat if you're not feeling well. This is the other aspect of these cookery books. They're not just food books. They also tell you what's important for the diet, for hygiene, that kind of thing.
You said something at one point about the certain dignitaries or caliphs. I wouldn't eat dinner without having their doctor sitting next to them.
Yeah, some of those stories are so fascinating, like the one where Saif al-Dawla of 11th century Aleppo. There's a story, we don't know how true it is, but the idea is that he did have a physician. And here in this story we have in the book, he had 24 physicians present while he ate because he needed advice, medical advice. I mean, we don't know how true that is, but the idea of the physician present, that's pretty common throughout all of the caliphal or royalty stories.
Now, we had the experience of being in a museum in Berlin last year, which has some wonderfully preserved huge things, like the ceremonial route of Nebuchadnezzar or somebody like that, into Babylon, reconstructed in the museum. But one of the most fascinating things we saw is a merchant's room in Aleppo with absolutely the most glorious painted wood all around the room. We were just astounded. And we thought something we'll share with you, and I'd like to have your reaction to this, because we thought of all the nasty things that are going on in Syria today and all the really violent and horrible things. And back in the 12th or 13th century, this was the center of the civilized world with absolutely glorious art and all of those things. What happened?
What happened? Colonialism and imperialism.
Oh, dear.
The turn of history,
They lost power. In the world, I think myself, it's people who have the biggest guns, the people who have power that run things. The conquerors write history. The others that lose, and they fade away. History is good, like every 400 years, a cycle of history, as Ibn Khaldun, a great writer in North Africa, you know, said. So people get soft, they get like we were, like the Arabs do, had all these feasts and, you know, had a soft life. Then harsh people came from Central Asia, Mongols, Turks, all these people came from Central Asia, and they took over the society, and the society went on under them, but it was a different society.
Okay, I'm with you now. I wanted to just ask you one more thing before we close. We had a wonderful dining experience in London at a Lebanese restaurant. And I guess the Lebanese cuisine is quite similar. I remember there were lots and lots of small dishes that came at the beginning of the meal, and the recommendation of the owner was that if you came to dine there, you should come as a group of six or eight people so that you'd be able to consume everything that was there. We just tasted little bits, but I wanted to go on further because we were surprised that the prized wines that were to be served with this were actually produced, the grapes were grown and the wines were produced in Lebanon. Now, what did the people who enjoyed these recipes, what did they drink?
Wine.
Okay.
In Andalusia, the Muslims all drank wine.
Oh, yeah.
They weren't what you think you're thinking of the Muslims today.
Oh, I see. Okay, all right.
Because wine has been part of ancient society in the Arab world. I'm speaking now of the Middle East, for example.
Yes.
In ancient Mesopotamia, we're talking 1750 BC, there's tablets that have been found, and they're held now at Yale University. But these tablets have a great menu of the foods that were eaten and how to make specific types of wine from barley or from different types of fruits. These continued. Nothing changes in the Middle East. Food continues. And when it was at its glory, that was in the medieval times, as we've shown in our book.
Right. Now, I don't think you're going to get a whole lot of takers for preparing stuffed stomach. However, there are plenty of...
I cook the food of the world. I've cooked in all Asian food, European food, everything.
Right. Well, I think, I was about to say that I think that there are a lot of recipes here that the modern palate is going to love, such as seared eggplant with walnuts. The use of nuts is particularly appealing. Honeyed carrots in rose water, another thing.
Yes.
I just want to bring your attention to a dish called Burania that's in the book. It's eggplant and lamb. You were saying about an eggplant dish.
Yes.
See, why we picked that, you asked us why we chose certain recipes and so on. That dish enticed us because the dish was named after or for or by the Caliph al-Ma'mun's wife. And it was served at their wedding. And the story goes, the anecdote goes that the dish was named after her because it was served at their wedding. Previous to this, eggplant was not an exciting vegetable.
In fact, in Arabic, the term for eggplant in the medieval sources, prior to being used as a culinary necessity in a sense, it was referred to as a, well, I'll give you a straight translation. the testicles of the devil. That's what it looked like to people.
The devil must have been a big guy. Huh?
Yeah. That's right. People didn't want to. It was only like now modern days that somebody in the upper echelons of society or somebody we admire eats something or puts their hair a certain way.
Right.
We want to emulate them. So as it was in the 9th century, Buran marries the Caliph al-Ma'mun, and she loved eggplant. So she had this eggplant dish served at her wedding. Then everybody started to eat it.
Right. Well, so I was just pointing out that these may be ancient flavors and recipes, but there's a lot of appeal to modern cooks and diners. And I think that I'd like to repeat the name of the book again: Scheherazade's Feasts, Foods of the Medieval Arab World. And listeners, get a hold of this. You'll get a lot of history and a lot of colorful anecdotes along with really exciting recipes. And I thank you, Salooms.
And we enjoyed doing it with you.
Yes, and we would like to invite you all to come enjoy a feast in our house as well.
Oh, that would be good. We're always up for that.
Now, which house is that one? Is that in ours?
By the way, Lebanese food is that same food that's in that book.
Okay. Now, where's the
invitation? That's the ancestors of Lebanese food. Lebanese food is no different than Syrian or Palestinian or Jordanian, or they're all the same. Because it used to be one country, usually.
But after doing this book, we realized what we eat nowadays is simple foods compared to what they had then.
Now, are we coming to Toronto or are we coming to Allentown?
You're coming to Toronto and Allentown in the good Arab hospitality tradition.
Ya mit ahlo sahla.
There you go. My sister said 100 welcomes.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a delight to talk to you all.
It was delightful, too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And to round out today's program, after all, we've had Russian cooking, we've had Latin American street food, we've had historical food from the Mideast, now we've got a mystery new ingredient that comes from India and the Philippines, and you want to try some, I'm guessing, but let's have you hear about it first.
It seems to me that there's a new superfood every single day, and the latest one is apparently called moringa. We're going to be talking to Ken Marion of Green Virgin Products about just that. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you very much.
How old a company is Green Virgin Products?
We're going on 5 years now.
And how long have you known about moringa?
We've been selling moringa for close to 4 years.
Okay. And what is moringa?
Moringa is a leafy vegetable that grows on trees, and moringa has the highest vitamin, mineral, antioxidant, amino acid, and protein count of any other plant ever tested.
Who tested it?
Hold on, Ken. You said it grows on a tree. I mean, is it a tree or is it like a succulent? No, it's a tree.
Yeah, moringa is a tree.
Okay.
Okay, and who did the testing?
Oh, geez, it's on my website. It was like the International Vegetable Organization. I'm just making that up, but it was something like that. Should I be sitting in front of a computer now so I can answer those kind of questions?
Well, I thought maybe you'd just know it.
Think about it. We'll stick within the limits of what you have in memory, if that's all right.
Okay, so what else can you tell us about? How was it discovered?
Moringa's been used for thousands of years in India and South America, Africa. And it's been known in Ayurvedic medicine, which is Indian medicine, which dates back thousands of years. Ayurvedic medicine claims that moringa can cure over 300 different diseases.
Does Green Virgin Products claim that?
We're not allowed to claim that. Yeah, FDA is kind of strict with what claims you're allowed to make. But it is an amazing product.
What are the effects of taking it? I mean, I've been using the tea bags,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't sure what effect to look for.
Well, it's not a drug, you know. It's more like you're just eating a totally balanced diet. And some people will notice an effect if their diet is deficient, and so many people in America today are deficient in their diet because they're eating fast foods or frozen foods, prepared foods. Most people do not cook their own meals, and the food you're buying in the in restaurants is sadly lacking. So if you are deficient in certain vitamins, minerals, et cetera, you will feel a difference.
Now, which vitamins and minerals in particular is it rich in?
Just about every vitamin and mineral you can think of. Hold on a second. I'm opening up my website here. I can read you the list. I mean, the list is huge. I was amazed at what's in there. But it's not just vitamins and minerals. It's got all the essential amino acids, which essential amino acid is something that your body can't synthesize. The only way to get it is through your diet. But Moringa contains all of them. It's got the twice as much antioxidants as any other food.
I'm reading about this now. I just don't know how much you have to take or how do you determine it, because I was taking two mugs of Moringa tea a day and didn't realize anything.
Well, you probably have a healthy diet, but just because you didn't feel an effect doesn't mean it's not helping you. The recommended daily dose is 2 grams a day, which would be one tea cup of tea a day. Or if you're buying the powder, 2 grams of powder, or it also comes in capsules. It's 5 capsules per day.
Now, where do you get it from? Is it somebody, you buy it in India, or is it grown somewhere here in the United States?
Southern California.
Now, we got ours from the Philippines. In the Philippines, they actually have wild Moringa jungles, where the predominant plant in the jungle is Moringa. And that's where we get ours from. It's sourced from the Philippines. Our advanced processing and packaging system, when we harvest leaves from the trees, we don't cut down the whole tree. We just trim the trees, get the leaves. The leaf is the most nutritious part.
Now, when you say weekend, I mean, you have workers in the Philippines working for you?
Technically, no, but okay. We have an exclusive agreement with the farm in the Philippines.
Got it.
It's
okay.
Not just
sure,
a farm, but they also, it's a research institute, and they have the most advanced packaging in the world. Moringa is very susceptible to oxidation, which is what you get when you slice an apple and it turns brown.
Yep, got it.
So if Moringa is not kept in an oxygen-free environment with 100% of the light being blocked out, it will oxidize and lose most of its nutritional value. And we're the only company in the United States that packages it that way. So ours is by far the most potent Moringa that you can buy in America.
Now, you also convert it, though, into ground varieties and into tea leaves as small as enough to go in an infusion tea bag.
Yeah, a tea, you know, in tea bags already. We make a powder, and we make capsules, both vegetarian capsules and regular gel caps. And we also have a new product, which is totally exclusive to us. It's Moringa Ultimate Superfine Powder. Most Moringa powder, well, we're the only ones that have one, Moringa powder that will actually dissolve in water. Most Moringa powder, when you stir it in, it just settles on the bottom right away.
And by the time you've done all this processing to it, it's become stable, right? So it's retaining its values?
Exactly. And with our exclusive oxidation-free packaging, our Moringa has a 2-year shelf life, so very stable.
Now, quickly run through, you have a few other rather interesting green forest products.
Before you do that, the out of this Moringa, there are other grooming products made from this leaf, including the soap, moisturizer,
yeah,
and some kind of oil.
Exactly. The oil is made from the seeds of the Moringa plant.
Okay.
And it's weird because Moringa leaves are very susceptible to oxidation. Moringa oil is the longest-lasting oil on the planet. A lot of people say it never goes bad. They found Moringa oil in the tombs of the ancient pharaohs. But Moringa oil is one of the best moisturizers on the planet. And when you go to the fancy stores and they try and sell you this anti-aging cream where you get a tiny little container and it costs hundreds of dollars, they all have Moringa oil in them.
Oh, okay. All right.
So pure Moringa oil is very good for anti-aging effects. I have letters from customers saying how their face looks so much better and younger and wrinkles are going away, and it's just an excellent moisturizer.
So you're having a lot of success with this product.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very popular.
We encountered it in Details Magazine, and it's called The Next Superfood is Here.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And it tells you can get it in health food stores. But you warn that there's a big difference from one producer to the next.
Yeah. A lot of the Moringa you buy in a health food store, because they don't package it properly, is almost totally worthless because it's oxidized. And when that happens, it destroys the nutritional value.
Okay. And so the best place to get it is off your website?
Yeah, at greenvirginproducts.com.
Okay, wow.
And we are working with a distributor to get it in stores nationwide, but it's just in the beginning right now.
Yes, well, is there anything else that we need to know about this?
You want me to read you the list of ingredients?
No,
or
it's very long.
Yeah, it's got just about everything you ever heard of in there.
Yeah, it's on the website, listeners, and the website is
greenvirginproducts.com. Exactly.
So if you want to buy a Green Virgin, you now know where to go. You never thought about that, did you, Ken?
No. And there's tons of reviews on the website written by consumers and customers.
I can just imagine what your logo might look like.
We're not going to go there.
Ken, thanks a lot for joining us today. And keep up the great work and keep us informed as you make new, fascinating, wild products that are good for you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Ken. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's program, and you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.